MAC committee. This actually represents the first in-person meeting we've had since a little bit of changeover in membership, so I want to do brief introductions in a moment. Those of you in the audience from the public, if you intend to make a comment during the public comment period, you're encouraged to sign up in the back. There's a sign-up sheet on the table. Please just jot your name down so we can get a handle on how many people might want to speak during the public comment session so I can gauge time appropriately. We have a lot of business to cover today. Thanks again for everybody coming. I just want to go down the list of new members and old members, just reintroduce ourselves. If you don't mind, I'll start to my right with Dan, and we'll work our way down. Just a brief introduction, especially for those who are new to the committee.
Okay, Dan Knott, and I'm with the Virginia Watermen Association and work on the water.
Ken Schultz from Accomack, recreational fisherman.
Chris Moore, Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
AJ Erskine, Bevan's Oyster Company, Coward Seafood.
Shanna Madsen, I'm with VMRC, and I'm on the Menhaden Technical Committee.
And Shanna's also the vice chair of this committee. Rob Latour from Virginia Institute of Marine Science and chair of the committee, the MAC committee.
Craig Freeman, our charter boat captain.
Ken Pankert, UFCW Local 400.
Monty Deal, represent the Menhaden Reduction Industry.
Mike Leonard, American Sport Fishing Association with the recreational fishing industry.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Somers was nice enough to send around minutes from the last meeting. I didn't personally see any comments come in for suggested changes or edits. But if you have any, now's the time before I ask for a motion to approve the minutes from September. So anybody have any adjustments, comments, or clarifications for the September minutes? Not seeing anybody, so a motion to approve minutes from September 12th.
So moved.
Second. Thanks. Anyone opposed? All right, minutes are approved for the record. Thanks so much. Anyone here from the public who wishes to make a comment that pertains to materials or ideas or thoughts that are not specifically on the agenda? Okay.
I had a lengthy email
conversation with one of them. So that's fine, no worries. So we can move.
Is there anybody that signed up on the forum member?
I didn't see anything when I just went back there. Nobody signed up.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
That's fine. Saves us a little bit of time. So no public comment on things unrelated to the agenda. So that brings us to new business. Mr. Gear.
Thank you. That was I thought I'd get a chance to sit down for a couple of minutes.
No rest for the weary.
Listen to a few things, but that's okay. I just wonder if they got stuck in traffic or something, but... Okay.
So new business, some discussion from Mr. Gear regarding response to maintained spills, and then Shanna's going to give us an overview of activities and discussions that occurred at ASMFC just a few days ago before the holiday. So with respect to Menhaden spills, if there is public comment on this section of the agenda, I'll take it after Pat's done. But again, please identify yourself.
I keep looking at the back door expecting someone to show up, but that's okay. Good afternoon, members of the committee. It's good to be here today. It's been a long six to seven months for me and my staff, but we're here today to talk about our response to the 2022 Menhaden purslane fish spills. We've had, as you're all aware, we've had local and national organizations request the Menhaden reduction fleet be moved out of the bay. It was a petition that was passed around starting in June. It was given to Commissioner Green during our October meeting to give to the governor. About 11,000 names across two or three different petitions. And some of these items include their rationale for that. I will tell you right now, I am not going to talk about most of the things that are on this list. I'm going to talk about just the two that highlighted, the fish spills resulting in dead fish on the beaches and waterways and user conflicts. We've had issues with that, and it's we've had numerous discussions. I mean, since Governor Youngkin took office in January, We have had meetings with Secretary Voiles. Ms. Mazin and I have briefed him on several things, and Mr. Wheeler as well, on Menhaden issues. For the last 6 months, we have been having contacts back and forth with the governor's office and secretary's office. And what's being proposed today is a combination of them asking us questions, we providing them information, they come back to us with more, we go back to them with the information they provide, and the resulting proposal for our December 6th meeting is a result of that, which I'm going to talk about. I will say that the recommendations we're putting forward are not for one sector only. They're for both the bait and the reduction fleet, because we manage by gear type. The bait purseine and a reduction purseine both use the same type of vessels and the same kind of fishing gear. So we can't discriminate against one versus the other. So these recommendations that are being put forward are for both the bait and the reduction fleet. You need to be aware of that. We've had a number of net spills this year that were pretty, we have about three per year on average, but this year most of them weren't as big as some of the ones in the past, but a lot of notoriety to them, several of them coming ashore. We had one on roughly July 1st in Silver Beach. The source is unknown. Law enforcement is pretty sure it came from a purseine, based on some information they have. These fish started littering the beach around July 4th weekend. So I got a call on the morning of July 5th from DEQ saying, hey, there's a fish spill. I said, okay. And I documented like we normally do. That afternoon, Andy Hall from Omega Protein called me to say, hey, we have a fish spill. I said, yeah, I'm aware of it already. He said, no, this just happened 15 minutes ago. I said, oh. A fish spill, so Ocean Harvesters, which is the fishing vessels that are employed by Omega Protein, they called in and reported it. They had a spill, gave them the wind direction and the currents. They knew it was going to be washing ashore, and they washed up right on the same area as Silver Beach on July 5th. Fish were washing ashore. They deployed their contractor, cleanup contractor, Hapico, and there was an estimated 19,582 fish. This got a lot of notoriety because they cleaned the fish up, but the dumpster stayed on site for a better part of a week because of municipalities' policies on refuge. So we couldn't take it. They couldn't take it to one dump. They couldn't take it to another dump. So it sat in the parking lot, and several politicians started getting involved with issues. On July 25th, I got another call from Andy saying that they were just about done pumping out a set, and near the bottom of the net, they noticed that. As described to me, was more than a few red drum were in the bottom of the net. So they rolled the net, hoping that some of those fish would get out and survive. Those fish started washing ashore on Kiptopeque State Park the next day, the 26th. All Omega vessels and the contractors, Hapico, addressed that spill. They didn't fish for 2 days. The estimates from the cleanup were 10,000 menhaden, or 6,700 pounds, and 264 red drum, which was about 12,000 pounds. We got that 264 number based on we went ahead and sampled some of those fish. Some of those fish were returned to Reedville. My staff, Ethan Simpson, and staff in the aging lab went up there in 100-degree heat. These fish hadn't been on ice for 2 days. They were really nasty. But they worked them up. They took lengths and they took otoliths out of the fish, and we've been aging those fish. And there's the information there. The average length was 48 inches. They ranged from almost 43 to almost 54 inches long. The average weight was about 45 and a half pounds, ranging from just under 32 to just over 56 pounds. And the oldest fish that we've aged to date was 49 years old. 13 of those fish were citation, above the minimum size of citation. So it was an unusual event. Since in my 5 years I've been here, we've never seen anything like this. But, there were large fish washing up on the beaches. And, Omega Protein and their contractors did clean it up as quickly as they could. But it just brought more attention with the petition to move the menhaden fleet out of the bay. It just brought more attention to what was going on. Just, I mean, we've talked about this in the past in some of our other meetings. Some of the factors that cause spills, it's the depth of the water. If they're in shallow water, they can snag on obstructions on the bottom. If they start dragging a lot of sediment, the nets can tear. The size of the fish school, if the school is too large, it might, you know, or the sheer weight of it could tear the net. Why fish wash ashore? It's primarily wind and currents, so depending on where you are. If it's on the eastern shore, winds from the southwest would push those fish on the beach. If it's Virginia Beach, it's going to be, you know, north and northeast winds, depending on where you are, and the tides and the currents. Distance from shore, you know, will influence is strongly by, you know, the direction and magnitude of the tide. So the further offshore you are, the less, you know, less likely that those spills are going to come ashore. But in the case of the one on the 25th, the wind was blowing 25 knots for about 4 days straight, and so they knew they were coming ashore just because of the wind. I mean, the stories I saw in the news, you can see the white caps coming into the beaches there. We do have other contributors to what we call fish spills, fish kills. We have hypoxic events that occur. We've had a chemical spill since I've been here on the James River that killed some fish as well. So, and, you know, some people dump fish. We've had a report since I've been here of someone dumping a large amount of fish. And that's what's called wanton waste. You know, when someone does that, that is, you know, definition of wanton waste is deliberately dumping something. And we had somebody do that back in 2018, I believe, large number of fish. As Mr. Deal had pointed out when he gave a presentation to this group, and he also gave a presentation to our commission in July, just, you know, showing the vessels and when the purse seine boats, you know, so pulling in the net, as shown in a one lower picture, they have very little maneuverability. And so they're at the mercy of the wind and the currents. And then when the mothership comes alongside to start pumping out the net, and what they say, pulling the net up dry, as a lower depiction in the lower left, they're at the mercy of the wind and the current. So it's like if they're moving along and they start dragging on the bottom and they hook on an anchor or any kind of snag that's on the bottom, they can tear the net and fish are lost. So we've historically reported spill. We've had spill reports that we get when these occur. I have started doing this since I've come on board in 2018. I've started maintaining a database and not just an email trail. So we have a database when somebody calls. We ask for the time it occurred, the location, lat long, the circumstances, the estimated number of fish, the vessel name, the tide conditions, things like that. So if we're going to deploy law enforcement or our staff to go look at it, we know where to go and we know what we're looking for. If Omega Protein is the responsible party, they monitor the situation and they deploy their contractors if necessary. Andy Hall and I have an interesting, you know, like I said, when he calls me, it's never good news. But it's and he's very good about calling me. They provide updates on a regular basis. For the spill on the 25th, we were talking as much as two times a day. When I got a call at 5:30 in the morning, I knew it wasn't good the next day. We always tell law enforcement about it. We get those daily updates. And we're storing that information along with any time we get a report of a fish spill or a fish kill, if we investigate it, we store that in the database. And since 2008, we've had 24 instances of spills, fish kills, and dumping of fish. 17 of those have been confirmed spills by purse seines. And the other ones have been unknown or fish dumps or fish kills. Okay. You've all seen this graph before, this map before, but these are our fish spills that we've had. Since 2018 through 2022, the top is for the purse seines, and the other is for other unknown sources. When I say purse seine, it's both bait purse seine and reduction purse seine. And if it says missing amount, we did not get an estimate of how many fish were lost. And if you want to, you can kind of look the average number. Why is my mouse not working on this? Here we go. The average number for each one of these spills is about 99,000. So for those spills, it would be about another 300,000 fish if you took the average. So, and I have the pounds on there as well, and it shows the minimum and maximum as low as 5,000 fish and as many as 300,000 fish. The graph on the right shows the location where they occur. The red dots represent the purse seine fishery, bait and reduction. And the size of the circle, the magnitude of the spill. and the squares represent all other spills. And the little black dots are public beaches along, you know, along the different shores. So going from Grandview, Buck Row, Fort Monroe, Willoughby, coming down to Chicks Beach, down to Virginia Beach, Kipta Peak, Silver Beach, and up the beach that way. Those orange circles represent the spills that we had in 2002. The one, the lower one to the south is at Kipta Peak, and then we had the two up around Silver Beach, the one on the 5th and the one that we projected was on July 1st. We also had one that was reported on social media just north of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel on August 30th. Several reports on social media, somebody taking pictures. You know, we started. I got a phone call from Mr. Atkinson about it. I said, we can't do anything unless we have the information that I just showed you, latitude, longitude, things like that. We never got anything else. We just got a couple of pictures of some dead fish. So we can't really document that as a fish spill if we don't have the information. So, but, you know, there was some question about that in one of our commission meetings. Was, why isn't this been documented? Every time we do have a spill, we start getting phone calls from all around the state. We've had people up around Kings Mill say, you know, oh, these fish, there's some dead fish that must be associated with that fish spill. No, that fish spill was, you know, 60 miles away. It had nothing to do with it. But it kind of, every time there's a spill, there's more people that we get the phone calls about. But we try to investigate as many of them as we can. All total, like I said, of the 24 of the spills that we've had, 17 of them have been associated with the Persanes. But it only accounts for 0.06% of our Virginia menhaden quota for the time period. What's being proposed is one of the things that's being proposed is a shoreline buffer, and the purpose of this is to, you know, prevent spills by moving the Persane fleet in, further offshore into somewhat deeper waters that may possibly reduce the nets from tearing and you know, being caught on the bottom and tearing and fish washing up on the public beaches. The proposal is to prohibit the harvest of menhaden for all Persane in the Chesapeake Bay waters of the Commonwealth from the mean low water to 1 nautical mile offshore. So a buffer around the entire Chesapeake Bay. And that's what this would look like. That's shown in pink. It's the entire Chesapeake Bay and Virginia Beach. Virginia Beach, which is everything east of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, which, I don't know, you can't see the pointer on this, but you know where the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel is. It's about 369 square miles. The proposal is for year-round. The reduction fleet, we have data for the reduction fleet from 2016 to 2020. I have not received the 2021 Captain's Daily Fishing Reports from the Beaufort Lab, the NIMS Beaufort Lab yet, and we've been using that for a number of things that we've presented to this group in the past. And that it represents 6.6% of the Bay effort during that time period is within the buffer. The bait fleet, we didn't have those CDFRs before 2018, so we hurried to basically find what we could and then enter the rest of it. So we scurried and entered, spent a lot of time late at night trying to enter this data to get it done, and so did my staff. And it represents, you know, 5.45% of their effort is occurring within this buffer. Combined, it's 7.21% is within this 1 mile buffer. So on December 6th, when this moves forward to the public hearing, if it's approved, these areas would be prohibited for persane fishing. It doesn't prohibit, it would just be displacing effort. It would be displacing effort to other areas of the bay or offshore waters. And you probably can't read that graph, that table, and I apologize for that. I'll read the numbers off of it. I had to try to get as much as possible. But you've seen this table before as well. The green dots are the reduction fleet effort from 2016 to 2020 that occur outside the buffer area. The blue dots on there are the reduction fleet that occurs within the buffer zone. The red dots are the bait persane effort. And the teal colors, which are mostly up in here, I can't see mostly, I guess you can see, there it goes, mostly up in there are the bait effort that occurs inside the buffer. And from looking at this, you can see that, I mean, it's kind of hard to see. It's the bay, you know, for the bay, it's about, like I said, 6.05%. And let me, I can't even read it myself, so I'm going to look at my notes for a second if you don't mind. Because I can't even see that myself. And I apologize for that. For the Bay, for, like I said, for the Bay, it's 6.6%, and for the reduction fleet and for the Bay fleet, it's 5.4% of the Bay Bay effort during that period, and 6.6% overall for the period of 2016 to 2022. I also, because we didn't have, we had a little mismatch on this data, so I looked at the data just from 2018 to 2020, where we had both data sets, you know, concurrently, and that was 7.21% of the total Bay-wide effort occurred within the buffers. Okay. Moving on to our second proposed restricted areas, the Chesapeake Bay Caution Buffer Zone. This is exactly what we presented last year. We talked about this last year. I don't think I've made a single change to this slide, these slides. So it's, you know, we've had a number of conflicts between the Perth Seine Fleet and recreational anglers in this area around the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. The area is popular for anglers. It supports a lot of different species. There's spear fishermen out there as well. There have been some confrontations that have been serious enough to raise concerns. As a result of this committee, we developed a hotline last year that not just for issues of this, but any marine conflicts. People can call in to our dispatcher and say, I want to file a complaint, and they say what it is, and we file that. So I don't have the information for 2022 yet, but this just shows the log from 2021. Off to the right is just what a complaint, an incident report looks like to our dispatcher. And in 2021, we had a total of 17 calls that were menhaden related. It could be anything. Some of those were fish kills. Some of them were interactions, complaints with recreational anglers. Some of them were interactions, complaints with commercial fishermen, general complaints, and there were three inspections. So we've continued this. We're going to continue this. I, like I said, I haven't gotten the numbers yet for this year, but it's just something we started doing as a result that we were at. Asked by this committee to look at, and we instilled it, and it's, I like that it goes through our dispatcher. There was a suggestion last year, like, well, we can create an app or something like that. I said, well, anybody can put anything on an app. When you call a dispatcher, a law enforcement dispatcher, you're giving them information, and it better be, you better make sure it's real information, because it's, you know, that could, I think, you could probably tell me whether that is. It's probably a misdemeanor.
It could be,
but it just, we felt that it gave it more credence if it's coming from the law enforcement, the complaints were going in law enforcement. And again, the purpose of this was to reduce conflicts in heavily transverse areas. The Navy's going through here. There's a lot of fishing effort. There's a lot of shipping effort. You know, we want to reduce the, you know, there's not a lot of effort in that area to begin with, but we want to, you know, keep them away from the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. And so, the proposal was to prohibit the harvest of menhaden by purseine within 0.5 nautical miles on either side of the bridge. And this is things that I've showed exactly before. On every NOAA chart, this is how the Chesapeake Bay looks. It has those purple lines on either side, which is a half nautical mile line on each side. So we have a one nautical mile buffer around the bridge. And right from note F in the NOAA charts, it says, maneuvering in close proximity of the bridge tunnel complex is discouraged. If the menhaden fleet has limited maneuverability when they're, you know, pulling in their nets, they probably shouldn't be near this area. So, and you've seen this before too. This is just the effort. It's the green dots are, this is all reduction fleet because the bait fleet has no effort in this area. So, total of 56 net sets have been since 2016 to 2020. Have occurred in this area, not a large amount. It's 0.4% of all effort, not just the Bay. It's a small amount, and that's probably why we didn't really address it last year when this came up. It's such a small amount. What did I do? I didn't touch a thing. Thank you. So, and then this is just a slide showing all these proposed buffers and what the results were. You know, within the buffer, the effort is the number of net sets, and it's the percent. The next column is the percent within the bay, which is for the total is 7.45%, and overall it's about 3.01% of all per seine effort. I put the 2018 through 2020 on here again, so as you can see, for 3 years of exact comparison, it's just under 5% of the effort in the bay. And this effort would be displaced if they're not allowed to fish in it, they'll fish in other areas of the bay or in the ocean. I wanted to show this because it shows all the proposals that have been brought forth by MAC and who brought them forward. And I want to really look at the ones that are highlighted, that are bolded. And, we're addressing those at these times. I mean, in March of last year, a one-mile safety zone around Chesapeake Bay Bridgestone, Mr. Atkinson proposed that. We took no action at this time. At that time, with these proposals, we are taking action. Address commercial recreational user conflicts near Virginia Beach. That was, again, by Mr. Atkinson, and we developed a hotline. We did that last year, so that's been in place. In November, Mr. Atkinson again proposed a reduction of fishery spill catch accountability. We had a long discussion about wanton waste. These spills are not wanton waste. They're spills. Wanton waste is a deliberate, dumping of something, littering in a sense. So we discussed that, but it didn't go anywhere at that time. And it was proposed to restrict the purse seine areas around 1 mile from shore during the summer months to avoid spills impacting beaches. And we're taking action on that. We didn't take action last year, and we're proposing action this year. And just the other ones, there was a subcommittee that was formed to look at allocation. Mr. Erskine put that forward, and we've approved that in the past. And just in May, we approved those allocations. Mr. Schultz put forward the wanton waste, and we've tabled that to try to deal with some of these other issues. Okay. But the ones in bold, ones that were put forward in the past that the committee decided not to take any action on, and at this time we're taking very similar action on some of these actions. Okay. This is new and hasn't been presented to MAC before. It says bay closures during holidays. The thought here is that if a spill occurs and the fish wash up ashore, in an area associated with a holiday, July 4th, Memorial Day, or Labor Day, it can have a large economic impact to these local economies that are, thrive on summer tourism season. And so what's been proposed is a restriction of all purse seine fishing in the bay the Thursday prior to and through Memorial Day, which is 5 days, the week of Independence Day, July 1 through the 7th, which is 7 days, and the Thursday prior to and through Labor Day, which is 5 days. The idea behind that is that it takes, those fish don't wash up ashore immediately. It could take anywhere from 1 to 3 days. So if you prohibit it before that holiday weekend, you probably have a good chance of keeping any fish from washing ashore if there is a spill. Okay? And here's, off to the left is a calendar for 2023, and the open season for 2023 in our regulation, in our code, it says the bay season can open the first Monday in May through until the third Friday in November. For 2023, will be May 1st through November 17th, which is 201 days. The ocean, which is east of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, is the same thing, the first Monday in May until the Friday prior to Christmas, which is May 1st to December 22nd, which is 236 days. The calendar off on the left shows that light blue is when the season, when all state waters are open, and if it's in green, that's when the waters east of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel are open. The red represent the proposed restricted the closed days for the holidays, and the bolded, circled ones are the actual holidays. So you can see Labor Day is on July 4th, Memorial Day is May 29th, and July 4th is, of course, July 4th. So it's 17 days total. It's about 8.46% of the bay season, but there are some weekends in there. So it's basically about 11 working days is what it comes out to be, because they typically don't fish on Saturday and Sunday. Again, I apologize for the size of this graph. This table, it's kind of small, but you can look at the top is the reduction fleet and showing the years of data we have for each Memorial Day, Independence, and Labor Day, and then the holidays combined, and the total number of sets that occurred for those years. And then below that is the bait, and then the combined is down below. The total, it's about a six. We're basically reducing effort, 6.09%. That effort will be displaced to the ocean. They will not be allowed, you know, based on historical data, they will not be allowed to fish. If this proposal passes through the public hearing, they will not be allowed to fish in the bay for those 17 days. Based on the historical data, will be about 6.09% displacement of effort into the ocean. We looked at 2008 and 2020, again, because we had concurrent data, and that's a little lower at 5.64%. Memorial Day had the largest impact with the reduction fleet at 3.15%, the bay at 4.94%, and overall about 3.28%. This will have an impact. This will, you know, basically it's forcing that fleet to not fish in the bay in around holidays. And it's like for the economic, you know, if there is a spill, there could be an economic impact to that. And this is what some of the folks on the Eastern Shore have been concerned about. So I'm not going to go through the whole regulation unless you really, really want to hear about it. It's pretty straightforward. It's Chapter 4 VAC 1270-10 pertaining to Menhaden. In Section 30, all we're doing is deleting subsection E, and we're moving that to subsection 65, and that will be the new subsection. We're creating a new section, Section 65, which is purse-seine area time and gear restrictions. And the first subsection will be that deleted Section 30E. And Section B will be the purse-seine temporal and spatial restrictions we just talked about. And subsection C is the purse-seine operator accountability for violations. What that will allow us to do is if there is a spill, the commission will reserve the right to have that captain come before the commission. That can mean come before me, come before Commissioner Green, come before law enforcement, or come before the board. We're leaving it broad. It's just so that if we need answers type of thing, we can, you know, we left it at that. It's, you know, we didn't want to go much further than that. There was talk about creating a license, you know, license for this particular captain, and it's sort of getting too involved. So we left it a little broader where it's just like, you know, if there was a spill, you know, we may want to bring the captain here. You know, law enforcement a lot of times will talk to him, but the commissioner may want to talk to them just to see, you know, see what was going on. And in summary, the proposed amendments to the chapter VAC 20-1270-10 pertaining to Atlantic Menhaden are to prohibit the harvest of menhaden by purse-seine under the following temporal and spatial circumstances in any waters of the Commonwealth of Chesapeake Bay and the city of Virginia Beach within one nautical mile from the mean low water, waterline, to any waters of the Commonwealth within one half nautical mile of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, so on either side, so that's one nautical mile. And three, any waters of the Commonwealth within the Chesapeake Bay the Thursday prior to and through Memorial Day, July 1st through July 7th, and the Thursday prior to and through Labor Day. Okay, and that's all I have. So you probably have plenty of questions for me at this time. So,
thank you, Mr. Gear. I guess the order of operations, maybe questions from the committee for you, starting with 1 mile buffer.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyone on the committee have questions for clarification on the 1 mile buffer?
So, originally, I think the administration proposed a 2 mile buffer. Why was it reduced down to 1 mile?
Who's the administration, just for clarity?
I believe it was the governor.
Can you say that again, please?
The information I had said that one of the original proposals was maybe a 2 mile buffer, and it got reduced to 1 mile buffer.
There were several options put forward.
Okay, so why was 1 mile decided on instead of like 2 or 1.5?
The decision came from the administration.
Okay. And as a matter,
I think they weighed everything.
As a matter of policy, nothing's been decided. These are just proposals at this stage.
So I said the original proposal from the administration was a 2 mile buffer. How and why was it reduced to 1 mile? I guess. And you said they just through talks.
All I can tell you is that I was asked to provide information. A 2 mile buffer was one of the items I provided. I provided a lot of different things to them back and forth over the time period. A decision was made that the 1 nautical mile buffer was the appropriate.
Any chance you have data like you showed where the effort was for 1 mile on a 2 mile buffer?
I have it.
I'd say it's outside the scope of the discussion right now since we're commenting on 1 mile buffer.
I have it, but it's confidential at this point.
If the spills continue, is there a process to increase the buffers?
I mean, we have the authority to manage this fishery at this point. So if that's what you're asking, could we modify this in the future? Is that what you're asking?
Probably.
I mean, we've been given the authority to manage this fishery. So whatever we think is best to do, that's what we'll do.
It's probably worth noting the spill is an accident, and a buffer doesn't prevent an accident.
Tide and wind and all that, by the way you are.
Good.
More comments, Greg?
Mr. Chair.
Or question? Yeah. The floor is still yours until you...
I'll be.
Okay. Is there an order? I missed it on the right.
Good.
AJ?
Thank you, Pat. I had a question about the percentage. We're talking about the buffer, the 1 nautical mile. So you had reported the percentage for the bait industry was 5.45% reduction. And that represents the reduction in the number of sets,
the percent of effort that occurred within the buffer.
Okay.
It doesn't, you know, we are under the confidentiality rules. We can provide the effort. I can't provide the catch to a public.
Yeah. Right. So I guess I'm not really, well, that's a question, clarification, I guess. But I would only point out that the volume within those sets, the 5%, may be greater than the weight and the poundage in there.
I would say it's not. If it's greater, it's not much greater. That's all I can say. I can't give you a number. I can say they were in the same, you know, they're roughly in the same values is all I can really say, you know.
Okay. Can I have a follow-up?
Yeah.
It's not really a question, I guess. It's more of a comment. Unfortunately, you know, I understand that you manage and make proposals and recommendations based on gear. But the bait and the reduction utilize the same vessel and gear. I get that. But the product that they're targeting may be different. So for the bait industry, for example, they're looking to target a larger fish, which it runs inshore at certain times of the year, and that's why they get inshore to get that product, or closer to shore, I should say. So that's a difference that I think this committee should understand between bait and maybe reduction. So, for example, if a one-mile buffer were to be in place, we would, as you say, be regulated more towards the bay stem, Chesapeake Bay stem, or offshore, where you may find smaller fish, which is less desirable for crabbers to put in a crab pot and less desirable for us in terms of size. So I know that's not part of a question, but...
Yeah, I mean, there was discussion, you know, whether or not we can do this just for one sector or the other, and we can't because it's the same gear. We manage, everything we do is managed based on gear.
Right. I understand that. Thank you.
Chris, and then Ken,
thanks.
I think?
Two questions. Thanks, Pat, for the presentation. Really helpful. First question, the shoreline buffer. Is there a reason that the Tangier area wasn't included in the shoreline buffer when other islands were?
No.
No.
It was just, they basically just did the east and west shoreline.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's
very little effort up in that area, as you can tell, too.
Yeah, there is, but if you look at the chart, there's actually a fair amount there off at least the fish hook. It looks like a fair amount of sets. But like I said, I wanted to see if there were a reasonable amount there. Second question is, in terms of buffer enforcement per se, have you all had discussions about would this be, you know, when the net was set, you know, you talked about them drifting in. How are you thinking that would work?
The code will be written that you will be prohibited from fishing, hauling, or retrieving within that moment.
So if
you drift in that area, you're breaking the law.
Okay. All right. Thank
you. The way it's written right now.
Ken?
How will you be enforcing that? What will the penalties be? And if there are further spills, what then?
Penalty will be, it's in the regulation, it's probably let me look at it real quick. So class 3 misdemeanor. Okay. there in that. And what was your second part, sir?
Well, how are you going to be enforcing this? And if future net spills occur, what will the process?
I mean, it's easy enough. I mean, law enforcement said they'd have no problem enforcing this because they can, you know, with GPS, they can be on that line and they can see if they're inside. Also, there's AIS that we can, you know, track these vessels on a regular basis as well, and they can see if they're inside those areas.
Right. So since you're able to track them, how is it that we have one or more episodes of spills where the source is unknown?
When I say it's unknown, it hasn't been reported to us. Somebody didn't admit to doing it, so to speak. Okay?
Okay.
That's when I say unknown, we
but
have...
But you could track the vessels that were in that area where the spill
occurred. We could track it, but if there's more than one vessel, we can't... So that, I think that's, you know, we could say that it was the same vessel that was probably associated with, but on some of these days, the wind was blowing so hard that there were some vessels that were 3 or 4 miles, some there were some vessels that were 10 miles, and, you know, with the way the wind was blowing from the southwest, it could have, you know, either one of them could be contributing to it.
Sure.
So.
As we've previously been told on this committee, the episodes of spills have largely occurred as a result of being in shallow water, if I understand this correctly.
That could be part of it, yep.
Right. And there, a lot of these sets that you're showing here have occurred outside of that one nautical mile. Are we to assume that a lot of the sets occur in areas where it's unlikely to have a spill for that reason?
The spills from last year, two of them were within 1 mile. In general, over those 17 spills we've had, it's about 2.2 miles. But the spills last year were hovering right around 0.9 to 1.1 nautical miles.
So in theory, then, if there were to be some more spills, it might potentially somewhere down the road be necessary to expand this.
Well,
you did propose 2 miles.
That's what Mr. Freeman was saying.
Right, I understand.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we would explore all options, yeah.
Yeah.
And keep in mind that, you know, these spills are not a normal occurrence. It's about one out of 1,100 net sets that they do. So three per year. It's a small amount. But when they wash up on shore, it's a big concern. I mean, it's like, you know, for the people using those resources, people using the public beaches, it's a concern. And it's like, you know, if we, you know, years ago before I was here, there was a spill off on Virginia Beach. And, you know, I still hear stories about that one, about how, you know, the implications of that. So it's like what we can do, you know, what we can do to avoid these spills, to mitigate for them is important. You know, we want to have a response that's proactive but not extreme, so to speak. So, I mean, you know, what was suggested, you know, one of the things early suggested from the petition was to move them out of the bay. We'll solve the problem. Well, that's a drastic response for something that doesn't occur very often.
If I could, sitting on this board, I represent labor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the manual labor, the guys that are actually out there, which I was one for 38 years, working on these boats and fishing them. And I'm not going to stop driving the car because I have an accident. I'm not going to ask close the highway because we have an accident. A spill is just what it is. It's an accident. But every one of these efforts, proposals here, directly impact labor. When you say it's only 6%, and I bargain contracts with these companies, and I bargain the wages, because the difference in fishermen and reduction and someone on an hourly job, you get paid by what we catch.
Mm-hmm.
And so that instance, when that is only 6% or it's only 7%, if you're on the other side of a bargaining table and you're saying, well, I only want you to give me 6% more pay this year, I'm not going to get much response from that in these times. But when they're coming to the table saying, you've already been regulated out of 6% of your pay, so I'm double digging down trying to get back to where I was 3 years ago. And so we need to keep all that in mind. You say the public, we're the public too.
Yep.
You say, you know, the recreational fishermen, we fish recreationally too. And, but we've been working these waters for 100 years now. And so keep in mind when we are talking as a committee, keep in mind when you're saying these percentages, every time you say those percentages to me, it just goes, you know, my wages.
These percentages do not prohibit the purse seine fishery from fishing.
No.
It prohibits them from fishing in those areas.
Right.
Or during those days. So you're not prohibited. You know, it's displaced, you know, the buffers are displacing it to other areas of the bay or out into the ocean. You know, the holiday days will be, you know, the days that are closed for holiday, that will be forcing the fleet into the ocean on those days.
Exactly, and that's understood and that's fair.
So when I use it, when I use that percentage, it's just to show you historically how much effort occurred in that area.
Right.
So you have an idea if effort remained the same moving forward, how much effort would have to be moved elsewhere.
Correct, and as you know, that we all know that Menhaden is a migratory fish,
mm-hmm.
and we know the patterns. We know the patterns before next year. We know where they're going to be roughly, approximately, you know, just from the data. You know, from year to year. And so there's reasons why we're in that bay certain times of the year and why we're in that ocean certain times of the year and so forth. So just say, well, just go out in the ocean and find them when you know where they're at. You know, it's kind of, I just don't want to get this hung on that we just, it doesn't mean much to the workers. It means a lot to the workers because I know I can't go to, if it's the week before 4th of July and they're fishing the bay, and there's no weather out there in the ocean, I know I can't just say, well, I'll just go out here to the ocean today and sit when I could be in here fishing in calmer waters or what have you and so forth. So I just want to keep that in mind.
Thank you.
So my plan...
Monty's got a question.
Yeah, I know. I just want to clarify so we know the roadmap. Take each one of these for discussion points. So next we'll move to the Bay Bridge, then the temporal closures. And then revisit them one by one from a more, are we going to have a consensus? Do we need to have a vote? That sort of thing. So just get the discussion out of the way early, and then we'll circle back to all of them for culmination. So, Monty.
Yeah, Mr. Gill, you mentioned, I think it was 6% of the effort is in within that mile. Where did you get that data?
Where did I get that data?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you take all those points that occur in the bed.
Right.
And then you take how many of those, you know, you have.
And the reason I ask, I mean, no secret. I asked Noah, Ray wrote, to do the exact same thing. And I got 14.4% of the bay effort is within a mile. And that's just the mile inside the bay, not counting what's outside of the bridge tunnel. Which is.
Same years?
Well, this was 5 years. From 17 through 21.
I did 16 through 18. 16 through 20 is what I used. So there might be a difference there. But really all it is like, you know, the total effort that occurred in the bay and the total, and then, you know, of that there's a subset that occurred in the buffers. And whatever that subset was, that's a percentage.
Right. I mean, it's just pretty significant difference between 6 and 14 to have. You mentioned, you know, that this is in response to fish bills. What would cause, I mean, what would cause it to be extended throughout the entire bay when there are certain areas that I don't know if there's ever been a fish bill, and if it was, if it reached a isolated, deserted beach or marsh, what does that have to do with the impact on vacationers or you know, all the other things that you brought up?
Well, I mean, it's primarily on the eastern shore. There's no doubt that, you know, your effort is higher on the eastern shore than on the western side of the bay. But you can see from here there have been some spills that have occurred on the western side of the bay. You know, really, not most of them are, you know, south the southern end around, you know, Grandview in that area. But you know, when this was proposed, multiple different ways, and this proposal was deemed to be the most appropriate.
I mean, the area south of Sandbridge Pier, deserted beach, down to the North Carolina state line. You know, the area up in the Pocomoke Sound, that's all marsh. The area off of Reedville, where, you know, this industry has fished for 150 years. I totally understand the impacts on, you know, that particularly the area of the Eastern Shore. But it seems like we took a nuclear bomb to what needed to be tactically assaulted, and one size fits all solution. I guess I'm having a hard time understanding the justification. And you don't have to.
Yeah, I would just say the justification would be there is effort occurring on the western side of the bay as well. And it's like, why are there more spills on the eastern shore? Is it because there's more effort or it's shallower? It's probably a combination of both. But, we've had spills. We've had spills along the western shore as well. So.
Throughout the entire western side.
Well, based on what I showed you, right. We haven't had any reported spills further up.
So when you were doing all this, did you look at it from a depth perspective?
No, I did not look at depth.
Because if we're trying to limit the spills and that washing up, and supposedly the spills go on a depth angle.
Depth would be a way to look at it. You have no idea how much work went into this.
Oh, I believe it. Oh, I absolutely believe it.
So... depth would have been a confounding. You're right. Having it by a depth profile, it could be enforced. It would have to be a 1 nautical mile is a nice round number versus having it being along a depth contour that maybe some people would understand. Other folks won't.
From an enforcement side of the house, but as far as what Monty's saying about tactical versus broad brush approach like what this is. Is there a way to get it narrowed down in certain areas, like right outside of Silver Beach or Cape Charles? Is there a way to do that, the areas that could impact?
Yeah, I will tell you that my role in this was to provide the information. Okay, I provided the information to Commissioner Green, who provided it to Secretary of Oils and the Governor's office. They would consult, come back, ask me to do more. There's more. So this is what they came back as they found a solution.
Dan, you good?
Yep.
Mike?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just real quick, of those 17 first seen spills since, I think it was 2016, it was on this slide a minute ago, do you know off the top of your head the breakdown between reduction and bait?
I want to say 2 bait and 15 reduction.
Okay. That's all. Thanks.
AJ, then Monty.
And I'll check on that for you.
Okay.
AJ, then Monty.
So I'm concerned, as Monty is, about kind of a blanket approach here and not something more targeted. When you say a lot of options were presented for consideration, were one of those options a spill response by industry and develop maybe a document that would directly address spills? Because I just want to be clear, and I think a lot of people on the committee have said, this is not going to eliminate spills.
Mm-hmm.
We could fish at a mile and a quarter, and for whatever reason, the depth, the wind, whatever it might be, there's still going to be fish that go up on shore. That is going to happen. So wouldn't a targeted approach be a little bit more appropriate with a document?
We talked internally about a response, and we talked about BIMS. I think Monty was involved with it as well. I don't know if that went into the conversations up the line.
Thank you.
Monty, I just want to be mindful of time. We have a few more things to get comments on and then shift to Shanna. So let's wrap this one up.
AJ.
Let's shift discussion to the buffer around the Bay Bridge Tunnel. Any questions, comments for Mr. Gear on that?
Do you mind just putting that diagram back up?
It's half a mile on both sides of the bay?
Yeah.
Both sides of the bridge, excuse me.
You've seen this before.
So is it truly a Is it truly a 1 mile buffer then? If it's just a half mile either side,
it's 1 mile buffer.
When I hear half a mile, I think it's half a mile. I think it's a mile.
But it's a total of 1 mile. So, and we did that. I mean, we did it because it's a defined area. It's easy to define. That's on every NOAA chart right there.
Yeah.
So that's why I know Mr. Atkinson also proposed a 2 mile, but I am supportive of this one because I think it's on a chart. It's easily discerned because it's on every NOAA chart. Versus if we went to 2 mile, it would be an imaginary line that we'd have to put in there.
And then can I ask that question now without any wait? So where's the demarcation line between the
majors? You can raise it. We've talked about it, but real briefly, go ahead.
So you talked about instead of fishing in the bay, they have to fish in the ocean. Where's the demarcation line that determines bay versus ocean?
Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel.
Okay, because most charts say it's from Cape Henry to Cape Charles Light. Most charts, most people say, like, from Cape Henry Lighthouse straight across to Smith Island Light on the other side is where
this got brought up in the very first Menhaden meeting, and we would require a change of National Marine Fisheries Service and the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission because that's how they manage the match on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel.
That's new to me, so thank you.
Yep. That's why I allowed you to ask.
That's fine.
Any other questions on the bridge? Yep, Monty.
So, is this a response to safety concerns or user conflicts, or what?
This is user conflict.
All user conflict.
This is a user conflict. This is directly a user conflict and a safety issue.
Okay. All right. Let me address the safety issue first. How many times has a Menhaden vessel struck the bridge? And since 1964, never. But there have been a number of barges and other vessels that have struck the bridge, and they've never been banned from that area. I just want to make that point. In fact, our vessels have rescued a couple of broken loose barges and prevented them from hitting the bridge.
We have a number of fisheries where we ban them this close to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. A number of our fisheries have restrictions around the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel.
Despite never having moving fisheries, not stationary gear fisheries, but fisheries that come in, fish, much like
a recreational fisherman who comes, does
what they're going to do and leave.
I believe they're mostly static gear.
Right. So moving to the user conflict, you mentioned that they're very, very low effort there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I agree. It's not a lot of effort. But what kind of precedent do we set when we say there's a user group that's been fishing in an area for 150 years, never had an issue, was probably the only user group at the time fishing there. Another user group comes in and builds an industry, you know, a recreational or charter or business fishing in the same area. And we get to a point where we can say, well, now there's a user conflict, so you have to leave. How many other fisheries do we do that or take that approach with?
I can't say right away. I can say that this percentage is a very small percentage of your total effort.
I agree, and I don't think that's the issue here.
It's such a small. It's not going to impact your business at all, in my opinion.
Does it set a precedent for other fisheries that if a user group comes and says I have a conflict with them, despite having no real history of conflict?
Well, we do have a history with conflict.
But it goes both ways.
With this fishery,
it goes both ways.
Yeah,
and you know that.
But we do have a conflict. I mean, it does go both ways, and I agree. And what this is trying to do is avoid that user conflict.
By prohibiting one group. Correct?
Yes.
Pat, is it fair to say this obviously extends beyond fishery versus fishery or sector versus sector because you have the common public involved as well?
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, you said in one of you think you have limited mobility, maneuverability when you're pulling in that net.
Right,
so
which is why after 150 years,
I agree.
Guys know if the tide's going to ebb. If the tide's going to ebb, you don't sit on the inside within a couple of miles of the bridge, and vice versa. And I think there's a very long history and track record of doing that safely. And now we begin to move towards setting a precedent where we do pick winners and losers for shared shared resources. That's my point.
Dan?
I am concerned from the waterman's perspective at the precedent this does set. And, frankly, around the Chesapeake Bay Tunnel, most watermen aren't out there anyway. But you always hear it. They don't want people oystering off their property. They don't want crab pots set in certain areas because it, user conflicts and things of that sort. So we just want to express that concern that I do think this is setting a horrible precedent.
Okay.
Pushing a commercial fishery out of an area based on a a very low number. And I think a lot of these, we determined that when we first talked about the user conflicts, is that a lot of these conflicts are actually recreational boaters harassing the commercial boats, chasing them around. They got their own website set up where they try and go out and harass these boats. The same thing happens to me crabbing and oystering. Got recreational boaters running by me when I'm hand-tonging, trying to stand on the, the gunwale of a boat. And so do we need to start reporting those and start getting buffers around open oyster grounds and things of that sort? So I just think that this is a horrible precedent to set. And I think that we can absolutely, manage this in a different area or a different way. But just from a waterman's perspective, totally disagree with this because I think that, you're going to see, okay, we don't want crab pots near New Point Comfort Lighthouse during, July 4th weekend and things of that sort. And so I just think this is a horrible precedent.
Let me interject with a little bit more structure roadmap. We are taking minutes, of course, thanks to VMRC staff. The meeting is being recorded. When this goes before the commission in December, there will be an opportunity for public comment. If you all as members of the committee want to distill your major points and concerns regarding each of the three elements, that can be entered into the record at that time, since there's a lot of good discussion here and capturing it in a vote or a consensus statement or something, maybe not doing it as good
and
of
I will share
justice
during the presentation.
I just want to make that point. So think about, as committee members, jotting down your ideas, your thoughts in a consistent, concise way that can then be entered into the record in the public comment section.
And if I may, we could have those minutes ready in time for the commission meeting, and we could put the minutes directly into their packet as well so that they have that information.
So, yeah, a little bit of quick turnaround on that, as well as on the committee's side to respond and make sure that the minutes accurately reflect the concerns being voiced today. Yep, Chris, go ahead.
Just one question. Pat, is there already a buffer along the Chesapeake Rivers Tunnel for this particular gear type?
It's a caution area.
It's a caution area.
It's just a caution area.
Okay. And is it the same area?
We're using the exact same caution area.
Okay. So, okay. Thank you.
Again, mindful of time, comments, questions for Mr. Gear on the time closures surrounding holidays? AJ?
I appreciate the intent, and I understand that. But again, this does not prevent fish spills or user conflicts. You can have sport fishermen out there at any other time. This is a very significant impact. Because it does not take into account weather days that we would not be out there or weekends that we may not be fishing anyways, a Saturday or Sunday. So, again, representing the purse seine bait sector, we have more of a truncated season than what was described on there. We don't start until the end of May. And last year we were done fishing, as I've said before, September 15th. This year a little bit different. We caught transferred quota, fortunately, and internal transferred quota. So we fished into the very early part of November, which is rare. So this truncates our season again. So I'm concerned about that restriction.
Monty?
Nobody else has anything. Would you mind going back to the one that has all the set data?
Which one?
All the set data, the dots.
The dots.
Yeah.
That one?
The dots, yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, AJ, I appreciate what we're trying to do here. And believe me, nobody in here wants, no fish on the beach more so than I do. Maybe you, but not many others. But, yeah, the fishery is prosecuted where the fish are, and the fish move. Up off Little Bay, up near Reedville, on the west side, May and June. After that, you hardly ever make a set there. You take away, you know, Memorial Day, the days before that. That's where the fish are. Down off of Cape Charles, Silver Beach, 4th of July and Labor Day. That's where the fish are. As they're moving back from the, you know, February, March. They're going up in upper reaches of the Chesapeake Bay, and these fish are all moving back out. The ones that are on the west side off of Reedville in May and June, personally, I think they go through the Cut Channel and they start going down the west side or the east side. You hardly ever see, you know, Menhaden boats in there after, you know, September, because the fish are now migrating from the north, and you're fishing in the ocean. It's a much larger impact than, you know, you mentioned, I can't remember the number, it was 8% or some percent. But you were probably counting weekends. You mentioned 200-some days. There are fishable days in the bay. You're counting weekends.
Of the 17, it would be 11 work days.
11 work days. But of that 200-some number from which you got the 8%, you're counting, you know, weekend days. And we voluntarily don't fish in the bay on weekends, mm-hmm. to avoid user conflicts. That's the only reason. We prohibit enough in other times, and in order for him to get a paycheck and for us to operate, you're going to be seeing us on Saturday and Sunday when I know nobody wants to see us. And we don't want to be there for the same reasons. So, you know, sometimes you have to be careful on, you know, how far. And again, the fish spills are the issue. AJ, I think, mentioned, you know, some of the things that are, you know, going on to try to mitigate those. But there's a lot of other, what I would call more common sense ways to mitigate that. And that is, don't fish within 3 miles of the eastern shore if the wind's going to blow from the west or the southwest or the northwest, which we should do better at. Totally agree. But to just, you know, set hard and fast rules like we did with the 1 mile everywhere, I don't know that that's, you know, the way to do this and still get the outcome that everybody wants. So.
And what I first seen when I saw the July 1st through July 7th, that's scary. That's a week's work. That's 7 days, working five of them. Well, you're working seven of them, but that's in 0 days. And that time of year, as you know, that's over. That's where we are, in the bay. So you say, go home for a week and come back after I have my party. You know, that's not good. That's not healthy.
Chris, I just... Oh, go ahead.
I have a question on process. Sure. Here at the commission meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have the... could it be possible that they reject a portion of this and accept the first two, say, and not do the holiday period?
They can do...
Could they make it 2 miles instead of 1 mile? Can they do...
They could make it two. They can make it... They can go less, but they can't go more. And it has to be within the scope of what was put into our public notice. So, yes, they could approve A and not approve B and C.
I see. So it's not an all...
No.
No. Or nothing.
They can...
Okay. Thank you.
Sometimes it appears that way, but they have the option of changing that.
Chris, did you... Yeah, I'll just kind of overall. I mean, you know, I think staff should be commended for the amount of time they put in trying to address several issues that we've been trying to address since we were formulated. And I think what we've all kind of seen through the discussions tonight is maybe this is not perfect, but it's a charge to try to get us to a better place overall. And I think staff should be commended for bringing forth a proposal that tries to get us there. And, you know, we can, this is a change, and obviously if we see that other changes are needed in the future, we can make those as well. So just want to commend staff for all the time that they've put in pulling this together and trying to get us to a better place.
So I'm going to propose strategy. Feel free to let me know if you agree or disagree, that we do very diligently capture the comments and discussion points that have been made and forward those to the commission for the December 6th meeting, as opposed to forcing us to come to some vote or consensus, because I don't foresee the consensus happening, and I really don't want to force a vote, just not kind of in our strategy. I'll add my personal preference would have been for this to be a more open process. I'll second Chris's point that, you know, I appreciate all the work you all put in. It is a tremendous amount of work. I've done similar analyses myself. But I think the product could have been more accommodating to all the different perspectives had it been more open and transparent. So does anyone disagree with that strategy? We'll work on getting the minutes in order. We'll work on distilling those down to major relevant points on each of the three topics. And that'll suffice as our contribution to the commission meeting next month.
Can I ask one?
Chris?
It's kind of related to this. So, Pat, I noticed when going through this today that comments from the public need to be submitted by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, which is a little different than VMRC has normally done, because you've usually accepted comments up till the day before. And I know the briefing book will go in. Those at 5 p.m. on Wednesday will go in the briefing book. But I know I've submitted comments Monday before the commission meeting before. Is that a hard and fast deadline for this meeting? Because it is a little bit of a change for VMRC.
To get them to the commissioners in time, because their packet goes out.
Right.
We need it by that. The packet goes out Thursday okay. morning.
But if someone were to submit a letter Friday, you know, what's happened in the past is whoever from staff was presenting would pass those out. Will that still happen in this case or not?
We can make it available.
Okay.
I don't know if we can make 9 copies. I mean, I guess we could, depending on what time we're, but if we get a lot of public comment after the deadline,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to be making copies for everybody.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That's fine. I just, like I say, it's a little change. I understand why that you all are trying to do that, but it is a little bit of a change from previous ways we've done public comment at VMRC.
Yeah. Yeah, accepting them at the last minute. I think we started that during COVID to get it a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And we just continue doing it because getting it until the last minute.
It's tough. I understand that.
It's tough to try to get that together. And basically you're walking in here the morning before trying to shove them into binders.
Yeah. And I know this one's tough, too, because being that it was the public notice came out basically the Monday before a holiday for 99% of us.
Yep.
It makes it a little tough, too. But I appreciate that.
Any other comments?
Do you want to take public comment on this at all?
That was going to be my next move, as long as we're satisfied. Everybody's happy. We talked about the holidays.
Hmm?
I thought, is there any more discussion on the holidays? We had some comments there. Okay, so the strategy moving forward is to distill into comments that will be supplied to the commission as representative of MMAC deliberations.
And we will try to get them out to you so that we make sure we're getting the groups.
And those of you who have offered comments, feel free to develop your own lists. Yeah. We'll just collate, send them to me, and I'll work on collating for synthesis and brevity.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. With respect to the discussion that just immediately transpired, any public comment? Anyone from the public wish to make comments? No. Shannon.
All right. Thank you, guys. This evening, I'm just going to do a quick update. You've been hearing me talk quite a bit about draft addendum one, so I promise not to belabor it. I know many of you were at the meeting or were listening in. However, I did want to provide the committee with an update as to the outcome of this action. I also wanted to provide the committee with a brief update as to what the total allowable catch has been set at by the ASMFC. So we'll go through both of these options, and then we'll talk about the resulting regulatory changes from these management actions. So just a really quick recap of the process. So the board initiated the development of draft addendum one in August of 2021. The document went through several iterations, and I can tell you that because I was on the plan development team and I thought those iterations would never end. and it was finally approved for public comment in August of this year. Essentially, this was brought forward. For those of you who might not remember, every 3 years, the board needs to reconsider its state-by-state allocations for the coastwide catch of Atlantic menhaden. So this was initiated as a result of that reconsideration. Public comments on this document were accepted the entire month of September this year and were summarized for the board to consider at their final approval in November at the ASMFC annual meeting, which was a few weeks ago. These management measures will be effective January 1st, so that'll be the TAC. And the changes to the state-by-state allocations. The remaining measures that I'll go through are going to be effective by May 1st, but I'll probably make any of those necessary changes earlier when I make the changes to the allocations and the TAC within our regulation. So this is a slide that summarizes all of the major options. We did get a lot of public comment that this document was fairly complex. A lot of the issues were interrelated. I talked with this committee several times about those issues and how they all work together for the state of Virginia. The main issues that the board was taking up with this addendum was to discuss allocation. That was done in two steps. So previously there was a fixed minimum that was allocated to each one of the states. And then the other part of allocation that was discussed was the time frame. The next part of the document pertained to the episodic set aside program, which is for the northern states to opt into a set aside amount of the total allowable catch for episodic events if there should be a large surge of menhaden to that northern area. And the last portion was in relation to the incidental catch and the small-scale fisheries program, which our non-per seine bait sector does participate in. So this was an important section for us to be involved in. There are several portions to that. We'll go over them briefly and how they relate to the state of Virginia's fisheries. So the first step was the allocation process. As I mentioned previously, each of the states was allocated a fixed minimum. Amendment 3 was what you'll see on the screen labeled as status quo. Each one of the states was given half a percentage fixed minimum allocation, which meant that 8% of the total allowable catch was already allocated to every single state or jurisdiction within the Atlantic coast. The option that was selected by the ASMFC Management Board was option B, which you see highlighted, and I'll follow this layout throughout the rest of the presentation, where the highlighted option was the option that the board ultimately selected and will be put in place through Addendum 1. Option B is a three-tiered fixed minimum option. And what that did is it slid the states into tiers based off of their previous landings. Of note, at the board meeting, South Carolina and Georgia did request to be moved from Tier 1 to Tier 2. So that did make some modifications to the overall percentage of the TAC that goes to the fixed minimum. So overall, about 2% of the overall TAC was reallocated throughout the states because option B was selected. So the second part of allocation is the time frame of the landings. This was probably the most hotly contested part of this meeting for those of you that listened in. Ultimately, what occurred was the board selected option two, which was the most recent time frame of landings. We had some debate over whether or not sub-option one of option three, which is the weighted allocation, 25-75, would go into place, or option four, the moving average, would go into place. But ultimately, the board settled on option two, which is the most recent time frame of landings for Menhaden, which determines the allocations throughout the coastline. So the third section has to do with the incidental catch set-aside program. There were two options here dealing with the incidental catch set-aside program. As a reminder, this was always set at 1% to allow the northern states to opt into episodic events that might be occurring in the northern region. For this option, the board did elect to stick with status quo, which was keeping the episodic event set-aside program set at 1% and not increasing it up to 5%, which was the allowance in option 2. So this final portion is the incidental is the small-scale fisheries provision. And I'll go through this in kind of different sections. We'll first talk about the timing, is what we're calling it, of this incidental catch fisheries provision. And then we'll move into some of the other issues that fall kind of under this umbrella. So what you'll see on the screen here is a number of options. Status quo essentially was the language that was in Amendment 3, which was kind of vague and unclear. Two states, Virginia and New Jersey, actually interpreted the way that this provision was allowed to be applied differently than other states because we divide our quota into different sectors. And so essentially New Jersey and Virginia were splitting their quota by sectors or by fishery, and then they were opting into the incidental catch set-aside program once the quota for that specific sector was met. So option one was really just status quo, which kind of left the vagaries in place of that language from Amendment 3, but the board did come to the conclusion that they selected option two, which is how both Virginia and New Jersey interpreted this language, which allows us to opt into the incidental catch program when the quota for that specific sector is met. That's incredibly important for Virginia fisheries, given that our non-per seine bait sector does usually prosecute the fishery much earlier in the year and utilize their quota much quicker than the other two sectors. So we were happy to see this move forward in this direction. So the next portion was discussing what permitted gear types fell under the incidental catch provision. Previously, the option, so it's an incidental catch slash small scales fisheries provision. So there can be directed gears as long as they are considered small scale. Amendment 3 did consider purse seines a small scale fishery. The board disagreed with that previous decision and selected option 2. So addendum 1 will remove purse seines from that list of gear types that will be allowed to utilize this incidental catch and small-scale fisheries provision. Finally, the board also discussed whether or not they wanted to change the trip limit for directed gears. Ultimately, I think the board decided that they would go with status quo, no change to the trip limit, given that you could go out and continue to fish pretty hard on 4,500 pounds or 3,000 pounds. It didn't really seem to make an impact, and really the ultimate reason that the board put this option into the document in the first place was because purse seines were catching so much underneath that incidental catch provision. So once purse seines were removed from that incidental catch provision, the board elected to keep things status quo for the rest of the incidental catch fisheries and the small-scale fisheries. And finally, our last part, which is kind of our most complicated part, but I'll try to, you know, make it a little bit easier. Essentially, what has been happening is with our incidental catch and small-scale fisheries, we haven't counted them against the state quota or the TAC. That's not to say that we don't keep track of them. It's not to say that we don't know how much is being caught. It's just to say that that doesn't actually go towards the overall TAC. So anything above and beyond the TAC is allowed underneath that incidental catch provision. However, the board selected option two, which evaluates that incidental catch against the annual TAC. So should there be an overage, which there had been previously in 2021, a very small overage, but an overage nonetheless, should there be another overage, the board is now able to, through board action, without doing an addendum and taking this very long process, either remove the directed fisheries gear type that is potentially causing this overage, as Persames did previously, or modify the amount of catch that those directed fisheries is able to get, so modifying those trip limits. So essentially, this is a fail-safe or a trigger put in place that if there is an overage of the TAC, the board can now take action very quickly to ensure that there are no more TAC overages due to this incidental catch provision. And so finally, this is just my very first slide with all of the option categories and the highlighted and selected options. And I'll take just a quick second to stop before I move into talking about the TAC to see if the committee has any questions about this management action.
Monty?
I don't have a question. I'll just say that that the staff from Virginia, you know, the commissioner, yourself, Mr. Gear, y'all did an outstanding job representing Virginia and, you know, and the fishermen's interests there. And a lot of people appreciate that, you know, because there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into that. That doesn't necessarily have to happen unless you take the initiative to do it. And a lot of people are very appreciative of that. Thank you.
Thanks, Monty.
Any other questions for Shannon on this section?
Okay, great. So now we'll move into the board's discussion of the total allowable catch. So what you'll see on your left-hand side of the screen is the resulting allocation changes that have gone through because of Addendum 1. You'll also see what the TAC was set at the top of the screen. Let me see if I can scoot. There we go. Scoot that way. Here's the TAC. Here's our 1% set-aside, so that's the episodic events program. And here's the resulting TAC after that set-aside is set aside. The resulting allocations from Addendum 1 are here in this column. And you've got our quota in metric tons and in pounds. So on the right hand of the screen, just so the committee is aware, you can see Virginia's percentage of the total allowable catch history through the years, as well as the history of what the total allowable catch has been previously set at. So at this meeting, the board did set the 2023 through 2025 total allowable catch at 233,000 metric tons approximately, which is about a 20% increase from the 2021 and 2022 TAC. And this was done based on the positive stock status of the updated Menhaden model. We did an update this year and showed that the resource is not overfished, nor is it undergoing overfishing. And as you'll remember from me saying this over and over and over to you guys, Menhaden are based, are managed on ecological reference points. And so the board felt that because the stock assessment had such a positive outcome and the fact that Menhaden are managed on a very rigorous statistical model, that a modest increase should be allowed. According to the TC analysis, this increase is a less than 40% probability of exceeding the target. Typically, the board goes with a 50%. That's like kind of the middle point where we usually end up falling out at. But
in the name of conservation, the board elected to go more conservative with their selection. But given the positive results of that stock assessment update, they believe that a modest increase would provide some additional fishing opportunities while still maintaining a very conservative risk level of exceeding the target. and then the resulting slide here is another slide that I've showed you guys a couple of times. So the top of the screen is what our resulting commercial allocation will be for 2023. That will remain in place 2023, 2024, 2025, unless the board decides that they want to reevaluate during that time frame. They are allowed to. However, they did set it for those 3 years. you can see our resulting quotas for each one of our three sectors. I will point out that back in 2017, the TAC was less than it was, but Virginia received an allocation that was about 10% larger. So because of the decrease in our total percent allocation, but the increase in the TAC, we're actually receiving an increase of about 10 million pounds from that really high point that Virginia received previously. Last year, we received about 333 million pounds, and we have about a 49 million pound increase coming for 2023 as a result of this increase in the TAC, even though there was a decrease in our overall percent allocation. And I'm going to talk about regulatory changes real quick, but does anybody have any questions about the TAC before I move into that?
Is that 233,000 metric tons now, is that very close, if not a little more than what the three-year average for 09, 10, and 11 from which the original 20% cut was taken? Is that
more?
So it's now more. Okay. Just, I know it was close.
So I went back and I looked. I have a little Excel file that I was using to try to calculate our TAC with our different percentages and how those all would vary. And I had all of the had all of the years lined up. So that first time chunk when Amendment 2 went first into place, we're receiving more than we were then.
So, Shanna, I know there were a lot of moving parts to the state allocation, and it could have been a whole lot worse for Virginia. So I appreciate the effort. I do have a question. In that table that you presented, at the slide before maybe, it was Maine. The top of it is 24, almost 24 and a half million pounds. What was their quota before? Do you happen to know?
I don't know what their quota was before. So they were receiving about, the problem is they were receiving about a half a percent. That was it. But then they were receiving a lot of transfers and they were using the incidental catch. So what I can tell you is that previously they were catching about 21 million pounds.
With all the
incidental catch and the transfers and everything else in the mix, that's about what they were catching previously. I don't know exactly what their quota was because it was just so volatile.
Right. So they were one of the largest increases in this.
Most definitely.
Reallocation.
So yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anything else on the TAC?
Okay, so final slide. Really quick regulatory changes. So like I mentioned in the beginning of the presentation, our Addendum 1 changes will be brought before the Commission sometime early next year because they are ASMFC changes. I can change those outside of the October through December timeframe to make sure that we're in compliance. It just depends on the timing of when I'll be able to get those done with our new regulatory process. So either January or February, be on the lookout for that. I'm just going to go in and update the percentages accordingly. So a very basic change. It shouldn't be too tough. The other thing that I did want to bring to the committee's attention is at our last meeting, we discussed internal transfer language becoming permanent that's in our regulation right now. We talked about the fact that it was only in place for 2022. The committee was in support of putting this in regulation permanently, essentially just removing the terminology in 2022, but then also requested if we could look into the process for receiving external transfers from a state to a specific sector. I did talk to our council about that request. Because of this section of code, so it's 28.2-203, which is essentially delegating the responsibility of the commission to prepare fishery management plans, assign fishing privileges. There are certain criteria that we need to meet as an agency using our knowledge of the fisheries, using our knowledge of the science. And essentially, if we allowed an external transfer from a state directly to a sector, that other state agency with really no context about our fishery, with really no justification or transparency, would be able to essentially cede our responsibility from us. So because of this section of code, there really is no way to do external transfers directly to a sector. And so that process is not moving forward. However, in December, I will present to the commission the committee's recommendation to make the internal transfer between the two per same sectors permanent. So that's the update on that. Does anyone have any questions on those topics?
Yeah, AJ.
I was the one that actually, you know, asked for that last meeting, so I appreciate the work by staff to determine that we can do that. So, just a quick question. It wouldn't be for the calendar year 2023. It'll be permanent moving forward.
Permanent. I'll just get rid of, just strike the, there's a little clause in front that says in 2022. I'll just strike that clause, and then that becomes a permanent part of the regulation moving forward.
So, yeah, a bit of old business, but that's a fine. Go ahead.
I'll just make the comment. I understand why we're doing it. We obviously had a number of conversations about it. I do think that with this addendum moving, having passed, Virginia getting more quota, it may be, it is time to look at our allocations again. I know we had a subgroup do that, but it's a different situation we're in now, be that we have more quota, and if the board would consider doing that, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
I will say that all of the sectors are receiving more quota than they ever historically have. So from a staff standpoint, I'd prefer to see how that plays out. If we run into an issue again where the bait sector is coming to us and saying, hey, we're overutilizing our quota, we're having problems, we need transfers, I think that's something that we can discuss. However, I will say that there has been quota left also on the table from some of those transfers. So I'd like to see how the fishery decides to pursue this new quota before we discuss changing percentages.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm not making a motion to make sure we do it now, but let's keep it on the table as something we may need to look at.
And I'm sure that the sectors will definitely keep us apprised of if it becomes a problem.
Ken?
Is the Bay sector quota affected in any way as a result of this?
Nope. So the Chesapeake Bay cap remains the same. So any of the additional quota that is delegated to the reduction sector needs to be caught in the ocean, cannot be caught in the bay. Great.
Good.
That's it.
Thanks very much. So we have finished up, as far as I can tell, the new business and spilled over a little bit into old business. We tidied up the transfer discussion that was from last meeting. Anyone have anything on other business? I guess maybe, you know, keep apprised of the allocation, as Chris just mentioned. Anything else that folks want to offer, Mr. Gear?
I want to apologize. I'll put this on the record to folks that wanted to listen in tonight and couldn't.
Sure.
We've transferred over to a new system, and I guess this computer wasn't completely resolved yet. So those people who will be hopefully listening to this tomorrow sometime, I apologize to them, and you know, apologize to the members of the committee, you know, because we probably had I'm guessing 10 to 20 people wanting to listen in. But I haven't gotten any emails, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, we have. Okay, never mind. I figured I would have gotten one, but just want to apologize.
So the recording will be posted.
The recording will be posted as soon as possible.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Anything on other business by anyone? All right, motion to adjourn.
Seconded.
Thanks, everyone. Appreciate your time, and stay tuned for minutes for distilling comments that will go to the commission. Everyone have a safe trip home, and again, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Right now, we're up on the Rappahannock. A couple hundred members, active, I would say. But the good thing, the organization.